You're listening to Work in Progress. I'm Ramona Schindelheim, Editor-in-Chief of Working Nation. Work in Progress explores the rapidly changing workplace through conversations with innovators, educators, and decision-makers, people with solutions to today's workforce challenges. The majority of the long-term unemployed are over the age of 45. A majority of hiring managers admit hesitating when it comes to hiring an older worker, fearing that they don't have the necessary skills for today's jobs and are not tech adaptable. Conversely, they say that older workers already on the job are valued employees. So where does that leave mid-career workers trying to find a new job in the post-pandemic workforce? In March, Working Nation partnered with South by Southwest EDU to bring together a panel to address this issue and examine what's being done to correct it. It was my honor to moderate that panel. I'll let the panelists introduce themselves.
Good evening. Gina Axius, I'm the Senior Vice President for AARP. I oversee our global thought leadership work. Many of you might know of AARP. In fact, I get told often that you get a lot of mail from us. But we're more than an organization that sends you mail, particularly as you start to turn age 50. We're an organization that's been around for more than 60 plus years. Our founder was a retired principal who went looking for her retired friend, who was a retired teacher, and found her living in a chicken coop. And outraged by that, she created AARP. Her retired friend was living in a shack, literally with no walls. And for more than 60 plus years, we've been an organization dedicated to ensuring that older adults have the opportunity to live a life of dignity with purpose and independence as they age. And we serve as a wise friend and a fierce defender, really helping to make that a reality.
Thank you. And Maria?
Okay. Thank you, Ramona. Thank you to Working Nation for inviting me. I'm Maria Heitkamp. I am the Director of Program Development and a Senior Researcher at the John J. Heldrick Center for Workforce Development at Rutgers, the State University of New Jersey.
That's a long title.
I'm just getting started. So I'm going to guess that most of you probably have heard of Rutgers. I think we have a football team. I don't think it's very good, but we have football. We've joined the Big Ten or whatever, but I'm guessing you don't know the Heldrick Center. So the Heldrick Center is about 25-year-old university-based research center that studies the labor market. So we do a wide range of looking at employer skill needs. We look at outcomes of education and training and workforce development programs. We look at programs that serve different populations of job seekers. I have been there since 2006, and much of my work deals with older workers and dislocated workers, so people who lose their jobs in plant closings and layoffs. Since 2015, we have been running a program there called the New Start Career Network. That program was launched in the aftermath of the Great Recession, even though that was a number of years after the Great Recession. But we noticed across the country, and especially in New Jersey, the long-term unemployment rate for older workers was very high. So long-term unemployment, and I don't know how many people in here have a workforce background. So if I get into too much jargon, just like somebody give me a penalty mark or something, but long-term unemployment is being out of work 6 months or more. And I know in the conversation, we'll come back to what the impacts of that can be. But we did launch this program because there were very few services to help these older, long-term unemployed job seekers.
Hi, everybody. I'm Wendy Sastrom. I'm president of the SHRM Foundation, and SHRM stands for Society for Human Resource Management, and the foundation is the 501c3 philanthropic affiliate of SHRM. SHRM is the world's largest professional society for HR professionals, and we have over 300,000 members globally. We have a shared purpose, which is to elevate HR, and our role in elevating HR is to help HR professionals lead positive social change in the workplace. And we have a really important pillar of our work linked to untapped pools of talent and helping connect HR professionals, define strategies and ways to recruit and retain individuals who are veterans, individuals who are differently abled, individuals who've been formerly incarcerated or impacted by the justice system, and certainly older workers. So very happy to be here, and thanks for extending the invitation.
And I'm now going to take this opportunity to introduce myself. I'm Ramona Schindelheim. I'm the editor-in-chief at Working Nation. We're a nonprofit news organization who tell stories about organizations and initiatives much of what these people do here on the stage. We tell those stories through videos, panel appearances, podcasts, many, many different forms. And this is one of the issues that we find doesn't get enough attention, and we're very happy to be able to share it with you today. So thank you for joining us again. I'm going to start with Maria, because Maria does a lot of look at research. She knows the data, and the jobs number just came out Friday. And I asked her to kind of take a look at what the state of the older worker, the mid-career worker, is right now, just to set the stage a little bit.
Okay, thank you, Ramona. So the Bureau of Labor Statistics put out the jobs report that was for February 2022. It came out last Friday, as Ramona said. It's a very strong labor market overall, right? We have an unemployment rate at 3.8% currently. That is the headline unemployment rate, right? So that measures, that's the number you hear most often talked about. For older workers, the headline unemployment rate is actually lower. It's 3%. And you would, if you just stopped there, you would say, well, that's a pretty favorable picture, right? Only 3% of workers over 55 are unemployed. However, you have to dig a little bit deeper when you're talking about the challenges older workers face. While they have historically a lower unemployment rate, remember I mentioned that pesky long-term unemployment statistic, that their long-term unemployment rate is much higher. And I apologize, I've got these numbers just came out, I didn't commit them to memory yet, but the long-term unemployment rate for what we call prime-age job seekers, so job seekers, workers between 16 and age 54, is 23.7%, right? So roughly, call it a quarter of them are long-term unemployed. For older workers, which they define as 55 and older for this purpose, it's 36.1%. So that's a pretty substantial gap. That means that a lot of the people who are over 55 who've lost a job are out of work over 6 months. The reason this matters is because there's a lot of evidence that something happens to job seekers after they've been unemployed 6 months. There's some stigma that seems to get attached to them. There was research that has found even when they're highly qualified, they have really good, they have the education, they have the skills, they have the experience that an employer is looking for, they're more likely to get bypassed for an interview compared to somebody who is short-term unemployed, even if they don't have as good a background.
So we've got a problem there where because you're long-term unemployed, you're less likely to get hired, but there's also the age part. And Gene, when we talked a couple of weeks ago, we were talking about this bias that we see, and I think we've all agreed on this, that we see this in the workforce hiring process. Talk a little bit about the bias as you see it through AARP.
Well, thanks again, Ramona, for this opportunity. I just want to build off of that. I think that one of the things that we learned last year, particularly during the pandemic, a couple of stats came out that is very eye-opening. One was that the World Health Organization released their global ageism report and found that over 50% of the world population had ageist stereotypes. And then when we did our survey at AARP, what we found was the fact that nearly 78% of older workers indicated that they either seen or had experienced some form of discrimination in the workplace. And that is up significantly from 2018 when we actually did this. In 2018, it was about 61%. And then in 2020, when we actually did this again, it went up to 78%. We've also done some work to look at exactly, well, what's the cost of age discrimination? What if you were to quantify it, because people are being involuntarily separated from the workforce or being forced out of the labor market, what's the cost to that in terms of our broader economy? And what we found was the fact that the cost of age discrimination was roughly about $850 billion in 2018. So when we talk about age discrimination, I think one of the things that is critically important is that it stifles economic growth, which impacts all of us. Not just older workers, but also all different types of generations. And I think that we all have a collective responsibility to really think about how is age discrimination showing up, particularly in the workplace, and how can we foster a multi-generational workforce?
You know, Wendy, as someone who represents hiring managers, you know, maybe some would look to you and say, hey, why don't you fix this?
We're working on it.
You said at the beginning of this conversation that you see this as an untapped talent pool. Let's talk a little bit about the value that an older worker brings in, and we'll get back to some of the barriers and how we're going to break them down.
Sure. I would say lived experience, work experiences, experience having managed through multiple situations, good and bad. But I think what's really interesting is that we were talking a little bit about this before the panel started. I hired someone that I knew prior to me interviewing her, et cetera, and she's 65. And after I hired her to run our apprenticeship program, we have an HR apprenticeship program at SHRM Foundation, she said, thank you for taking a chance on an older worker. And I thought, that didn't even factor into my thought process or decision-making process, but it should. And I hired her for the reasons why we feel that older workers are so valued. She had tremendous experience. She had tremendous experience working with multi-generational workforce, members of the workforce. And she just brought a cachet that I probably would not have been able to find had I not found someone with her level of experience. And the other thing I found most recently is that one of the ways to operationalize a DE&I strategy is really to make sure that you're engaging with older workers. And often, age is not a factor. When HR professionals are setting up their DE&I strategies, you think of race, you think of gender, you think of ethnicity, sexual orientation, and age is kind of just out there. And I think we have to be much more thoughtful and deliberate about making that a really critical piece of your overall talent management strategy.
Ramona, can I piggyback on that for a second? And actually, to go back, so Jean was talking about age discrimination, right? And we know that for older, long-term unemployed workers, there's this sort of double whammy, right? Mm-hmm. They've got the age discrimination and the stigma of long-term unemployment. Mm-hmm. So I don't want that to get lost. This is part of why they face so many challenges. And then the question is, how do we help them? Like, what are the public policies we need to help them? As you were talking about, so diversity, equity, and inclusion strategies, and that age is almost never part of that. Yep. But we also have to think about the intersectional categories, right? So we have older women of color, mm-hmm. and they face certain barriers that may be different from, you know, older men who are white, or, you know, I mean, it goes further, and they all do face different challenges.
So we did a survey of 6,000 global executives from OECD countries. And we released it back in 2020. And what we found was the fact that while the vast majority of these C-suite executives indicated that they value the multi-generational workforce, 53% did not include age in their DEI policies. Yeah. So to your point earlier, so there's this huge gap. And your point about the intersectionality is critically important, because even when I talk about the cost of age discrimination at about $850 billion, when you actually start to dissect that, what you find is that it's older women, and then when you take into account race, so you have this triple whammy. Yeah. So I do think that we have some opportunities to really leverage the older worker in a very meaningful way, particularly if companies are thinking about their long-term sustainability plans. How are you going to tap into the experience, the wisdom, the skill set that is, frankly, across different generations?
Do you think that there is a problem with, like, upskilling older workers? You know, we hear that term, upskilling, reskilling. That seems to indicate there's a lack of skills. So I don't want to say that, but do you feel that there's a stigma that older workers don't know the technology that we need? That was one of the things that we had discussed.
I'm happy to start off. Yeah, I think the pandemic has demonstrated how that is not true. I think that the pandemic has really demonstrated, particularly for those older workers who are able to work remotely or not, that they've been able to adapt very quickly to the use of technology. I also think that when you look at particularly during the pandemic, I really enjoyed this because you had older adults of all races and backgrounds on TikTok doing all different types of things. So I think the idea that this idea of upskilling and reskilling, I think that is something that we all have to do across different across ages, in part because of the fact that the future of work is here and lifelong learning is part of the equation. And I think that's critically important for all different age groups. But I do think that the idea that older workers are some of these perceptions, I think, have been disproven.
Do you want to go? And then
I'll tell you what, too. I can perpetuate some of those, you know, because I've got folks on my team who are late 60s and down to 26. And it's become kind of a really cruel joke that Wendy doesn't use social media very much or some of the newer technologies. And I kind of laughed at myself and I said, I'm doing myself a disservice and other workers who are in this older, moving towards an older worker category. By kind of acknowledging that, it becomes kind of funny and a joke, and that's when you
it becomes a cliche.
Cliche.
Self-perpetuates.
Yeah, and so even I, as a former HR professional, are still perpetuating that. We have to think really carefully before we speak and engage with others in the workplace for lots of different reasons, and that's just one of them. And age is something everyone will experience, right, at some point. And we have to fix this now.
Ramona kind of hinted that I am a geek for the research.
I like data.
A really good Urban Institute study. I think it was we're in 2022 now, right? So it was 2021. It was last year, looking at digital literacy, and which is a little bit of a higher standard than just basic being able to like turn on a computer. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we don't want to give in to the stereotypes of older workers who aren't good with digital literacy. But in fact, they did find that older workers, and particularly low-income older workers and low-income older workers of color and women, had lower digital literacy skills, which is really problematic given the world we live in. So there's still kind of a mindset that you go to high school, maybe you get post-secondary education, or you go to college, and then you go into the workforce. And that's it. That you know, I think we still have that as our fundamental way of thinking about how people, it's just sort of a linear progression through education and career, and then you retire. And we know it doesn't work like that. It can't work like that anymore. But we still, you know, older workers are less likely to be able to access employer-provided training. I think employers sometimes think they're not going to be able to recoup their investment because, oh, if I train that older worker, he or she will just retire. So it's not worth it. Right? So they have less access to privately funded, employer-funded training and less access to publicly funded training through the public workforce system. So we've got a lot of barriers in place.
I wonder, though, I think that given some of the longevity trends, and I totally agree with your points, that this whole idea of you go to school, then you get a job, and then you retire is an outdated model. I remember when I was in grad school, and we're learning about the disengagement theory. And I just remember, like, well, the theory was that you basically just do that, and then you retire, and you sit in front of your porch. And I was like, well, that's not how older adults that I know are really living their lives. So that model is really changing. I'm wondering whether or not, because of the fact that, you know, for the most part, you do see increases, for the exception of COVID, in life expectancy. Mm-hmm. So you do have that trend that's going on. And at the same time, with increases in longevity, granted, not every population is seeing this, you do have declined fertility rates. So there are these demographic shifts that are going to happen, particularly in the workforce, where companies, I think, will have to your point, look at their workforce and figure out exactly how are we leveraging the longevity of our workforce, in part because of the fact that that's the pool we have to work with.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I think that there is this misnomer that folks are going to retire and sit on their front porch and just hang out. But in fact, so many people find a sense of community and purpose, access to healthcare, certainly, at work. And so people are delaying, in many instances, their desire to retire or their ability to retire. And so we owe it, I think, to this tremendous workforce to continue to allow them or provide them access to continued learning, development, and growth. And if not necessarily to go the next step up, to go laterally and try something different where they can contribute their core skills to those particular jobs and give them access to that skilling and reskilling that they would need to make that transition.
So, Ramona, can I? I'm sorry, I don't know if you want to switch the subject, but I know you like anecdotes. So, a couple of years ago, there were a group of older, long-term unemployed tech workers who got, through a program that was federally funded, they got training in whatever the latest skills employers said were in demand. And they had very bad placement rates for the program. And part of the problem was employers would say, well, that's great. Now you've got, and I'm sorry, I don't know what the skill is, but you don't have experience using it. So they, you know, then it became a, you know, now they've got the skill, but the labor market is sending them a very mixed signal about whether that skill is valued. We also see a lot of older job seekers who study project management, and they get these PMP certifications and things, and there's no evidence that employers value that skill or reward them by hiring them. So I think, you know, there's also work to be done, you know, working with the employer community to help us understand if they get these skills, will you take a chance, you know, so.
And I think those skilling and reskilling too, there are hundreds of thousands of credentials, you know, certificate credentials, coding. And so what we're doing at the foundation is helping HR professionals kind of navigate those waters and understand how skilling and reskilling can fit into their existing talent management strategy and how they can work it. Not it turn the fear from if I train them, they will leave,
right,
go get a job elsewhere, as a way to demonstrate an investment in their people and in their resources.
So you get these skills and you need them to be able to look for a job, sometime perform your job, and then do some, taking some upskilling courses as well. So what do you guys have some thoughts on that?
What I will say is those nonprofits can be really important intermediaries in another, in a more workforce jargon, but important workforce intermediaries to help connect educational institutions and training programs with employers in a local area. You know, so I think, I mean, those can be great models. I think sometimes if people just go and get the training on their own, not connected to an employer in some fashion, I think it can be a lot harder. So, you know, those are the kinds of models, those kind of hidden gems that we need to look to.
I was going to say, I was talking with a group of HR professionals about our veteran recruiting program, Veterans at Work. The first question out of everyone's mouth, really, was, how do I find a veteran? Where do I find veterans? How can I connect to organizations like yourself or other community-based organizations? What kinds of questions can I ask? Is there, you know, I may have questions that may not be very PC. Are there folks that I can talk to that I can ask those questions so I can create this culture that's conducive to, in that instance, certainly veterans? And so I think we need to do a better job of connecting our employers to community-based organizations, veteran-serving organizations, because you all are the expertise in those particular audiences. We've got the hiring and the recruitment and shaping culture, but we need this to be a partnership in order to be successful.
The other thing that came up, lifelong learning, and in the audience too, is Marnie Baker-Stein, who's the provost at Western Governors University. And I think the model that you guys have done has proven to be very, very successful for getting people of all ages back into get the education they need to get back into the workforce. And I know you're doing some new programs around that. How do you get that experience, that credential? How do you get that in front of an employer? How do you get them to recognize it? Is there a value there?
That's exactly the major pillar of our work, is getting HR professionals to think differently about the kinds of experience they were requiring. Not every job will need a four-year degree and 10 years of experience. And so, but people can be slow to change. And when you're changing processes and how you're writing job descriptions and from where you're recruiting, it's a change in the entirety of the system. And we have to get buy-in from all of the stakeholders, right, within the workplace. An HR professional gets that person recruited in the door, and then you've got people managers, right, who are there to engage with those individuals as well. And so one of the things we're doing is we've done some research to understand what CEOs, people managers, and HR professionals think and know about what you just described. And I'll tell you what the CEO thinks and knows and values is very different than what the HR professional thinks and knows and values. It's getting them to kind of come to the middle and help HR professionals see the benefit of having these kind of alternative streams by which talent can flow through. But it does require a change in system and process and procedures, and that can be slow to be embraced.
So, you wanted to add to that?
Okay. So I think there's a national program called Credential Engine. Mm-hmm. I think they've tracked something like 800,000 credentials across the country, right? Yep. So it's a very confusing credential market.
And a credential could be anything from a degree to a certificate.
And so I think they are trying very, very, very hard task to bring some order, right, to what all of that means and how do you make that useful for job seekers and for employers. So, I mean, there's a lot of work on that front.
And Jean, for the worker side of it, AARP has the Skills Builder initiative, the program. Could you explain that a little bit?
Sure. So I got to pick up on a couple of good things here. The Skill Builders initiative is just that. It's an opportunity to identify what are some of the top skills currently, and how can we offer those skills training courses for free to those over the age of 50. And then for those who are really trying to go a little bit deeper, there's other types of credentialing opportunities that we have through our partnership that's been vetted, to your point, because there are so many. There's a couple of things I would love to just kind of throw out there for us to kind of think about, because the space of credentialing is so interesting. In that there's an opportunity for us to really think about, A, to the extent that was mentioned earlier, trusted sources. Mm-hmm. How do we help to ensure that these individuals who are navigating this credential world, that they're actually being navigated to trusted sources? The second thing that I would also offer for us to kind of think about is the issue of affordability and accessibility. And I think of the Joint Center, particularly in D.C., who's mm-hmm. really done a lot of work in this space, to kind of think about exactly to what extent, as we think about the conversation or we think about upskilling and reskilling our workforce for the future, to what extent are we ensuring that we're removing or reducing some of the barriers, particularly for low income or for those populations who don't have the opportunity for upward mobility. So whether it's the single mom or the caregiver who is caring for an aging parent, how do we ensure that as we're going through this process of transformation, that we're really providing some of the incentives, whether it's in the public sector or in the private sector, to ensure that we're meeting people where they are in order to be able to access those type of services? I think that'd be critically important.
Great. Did you want to?
I don't know if it takes us the conversation in too much of a different direction, but since we've got HR representatives over here too, you know, there's some movement to try to encourage employers to do skills-based hiring. I am not sure that I believe it's a thing that's going to really take off, but what that means is that rather than saying we need this degree or this credential, we just need someone to demonstrate that they can do whatever the skill in question is. So, you know, it's another area that might reduce barriers for people who have been unable to get maybe traditional credentials, let people who have experience, but maybe not a tangible badge or marker, have a shot at jobs that they're perfectly qualified to do. So I just throw that out there maybe for Wendy.
No, and that's exactly the kind of strategy that we're trying to bring awareness and attention to, and the majority of our members are small to medium-sized employers. And when I think of Markle Foundation, and they've got all these large brands and have infrastructures that support those kinds of initiatives, and often you've got an HR department of 0.5 people, mm-hmm. or actually they're not even necessarily considering themselves an HR person. They're an HR accountable. They're performing functions typically done by an HR professional. I think that it's a great way to engage in a much better way with untapped pools of talent, mm-hmm. right? But again, it's process change. It's what people are used to doing. And I know that this has been worked on. This is not something brand new. It's been worked on for years and years. And so that's one of the focuses of the foundation, is create this awareness to help cut through some of the clutter that's out there, certainly, and identify trusted sources, identify with small to medium-sized employers how they can make this work in their organizations, but it's going to take time.
Jump in one more time? Since you mentioned trusted sources, it is very hard for people to get unbiased guidance,
yeah,
particularly for adult learners. If you're in high school or college, you have a counselor you can go to about, you know, what do I do next, or maybe get some help. But for a lot of people, the public workforce system is under-resourced. We don't have the robust employment counseling and career management counseling available for people who need help. So, you know, an educational institution or a private training provider is going to say, yes, and if you take this course and borrow money and do this and do that, you're going to get a job. You're going to be in great demand. But of course, they're selling the course. That's what they're there to do. So it's another area where when we're talking about solutions, given the future of work, given technology changes, given lifelong learning and longevity, all of that, we absolutely need to build a more of an employment service capacity in the country.
One of the things that was mentioned is once you lose your job, no matter what your age is, it's harder to find a job, and particularly for older workers. So the idea of helping the workers that don't just hire them, how do you retain that talent? Because we all have agreed that this is valuable talent. There are people who are problem solvers, people who have institutional knowledge, people who have gone, you know, been in the trenches and have figured out how to, you know, make things move forward and built companies. So how do you retain that talent?
You invest in them. You continue to provide them opportunities to learn, to grow their own personal skill sets. You give individuals an opportunity to be mentors, perhaps, to other individuals within their places of business. I think it's not a one and done. I know there's a lot of veteran serving organizations and other kind of community-based organizations, and HR professionals think once they're hired, then my job is done. But just like everyone else within your organization, you've got to invest in your people. And I think we have to be very thoughtful and very deliberate about how we do that with older workers in particular.
Gene?
We did we have a partnership with the World Economic Forum and OECD, and we have a major initiative called Living, Learning, and Earning Longer that really looked into what are the practices that companies need to employ in order to not just retain their older workers, but also foster an age-diverse workforce. Mm-hmm. And what we found was the fact that when you actually retain older workers and foster that multi-generation workforce, it's actually beneficial not just for the team. You see higher innovation, you see greater productivity, but you also see tremendous continuity, particularly for companies. So this is really a win-win proposition. So I do think that part of what we've been trying to do is work with employers to do a couple of things. One is to really ensure that they're actually adding age to their DEI policies.
Right.
The second thing is to really think about exactly how are we taking age bias out of the recruiting process. And then the third is really thinking about exactly what are the benefits we're offering the workforce that are in many cases focused on life stage and not necessarily age. And what I mean by that is the fact that, you know, when you look at student loans, older adults have student loans,
mm-hmm.
right? So when you're offering student loan repayment. I've been trying to get ARP to do this for years, but you know, I haven't won that battle
yet.
Let's
team up.
That's the loan. But the point here is the fact that when you offer these type of benefits, it actually benefits the entire workforce. And I think that's one of the ways, in addition to flexibility, in addition to some of the other tangibles, I think that thinking about some of the benefits that are offered in a way that is focused on life stage, whether it's even caregiving leave. Mm-hmm. That benefits older workers as well as millennials who, believe it or not, are in caregiving situations. Mm-hmm. So how are we really thinking and reimagining what the workforce is going to be in the future?
Can I just jump in there on this subject? I'm glad you mentioned OECD. We have in the United States some of the weakest employment protections of any of our peer nations. Most workers are at-will workers, which means, you know, they can be fired. They don't need written notice. They don't, right? If they work in certain factories or they're represented by a union, in some cases, people have more protection. But on the whole, I mean, I could get fired, you know, like what time is it? It's probably too late today in New Jersey, but I mean, you know, you can be fired from 1 minute to the next. And, you know, that's a problem. I know, I'm guessing, well, I probably should put a little barrier. Wendy probably doesn't want to hear that. But I think, you know, we could use stronger employment protections for workers. We give very little advance notice, and the notice provisions we have are toothless, pretty much. There's another model that is used very heavily in Europe, almost not at all in the United States, but we have access to it. It's called work sharing. So what that means, if you're an employer and you're having a downturn, or there's a pandemic, or there's a recession, whatever it is, and you've done the math and you feel you have to reduce your labor costs by 20%, well, you could lay off 20% of your workers, or alternatively, you say, okay, I'm going to reduce everybody's hours by 20%. Those people are able to then get a prorated amount of unemployment insurance to help make them almost whole, if not whole. It keeps them attached to the employer, right? They don't lose their skills. The employer doesn't have the turnover costs and the churn and everything else for when things pick up again. In the aftermath of the Great Recession, there was all this talk about why didn't we use it in the U.S.? And then here comes the COVID pandemic. And again, for the most part, we didn't use it. So, and part of that is because we don't have enough administrative staff at the U.S. Department of Labor's Office of Unemployment. You know, I mean, there are some reasons for that. Employers don't know about it. Employers that have facilities in different states then have to contend with different states' interpretations. You know, so it's a little complicated, but it is a model that we know works. There's a ton of evidence, and it would keep people connected to work, which is much better than having people become long-term unemployed.
As tragic as this pandemic has been, it has also offered us an opportunity, particularly at the board level and the C-suite level, to talk about human capital in a way that I don't think we probably have in the previous years, mm-hmm. in terms of exactly how do you retain talent? How do you attract talent? I think every organization is going through these type of conversations and are having to relook through that. And I think part of what we're seeing, I know that we did a survey that we just released that talked about agency in terms of exactly in this current market, who has more agency, workers or employers? And what we found was the fact that at least according to the respondents, they thought that they had a little bit more agency. And in fact, you're seeing a lot of employers trying to respond to the demands of workers in terms of exactly what workers actually want, whether that's greater flexibility, whether that's higher wages, depending on the industry, whatever the case may be. So I do think that this idea of elevating age as part of the DEI conversation, at least in terms of retention, I think is something that is actually we're hoping to see more and more traction on. Do we have a ways to go? Absolutely. But I also think that, again, given some of the demographic shifts that we're experiencing, that companies, if they're proactive, will want to have some strategies in place. And that's what we're doing with the Living, Learning, and Earning Longer. We have about 63 companies who's part of this collaborative. They have over 2.3 million employees worldwide who's involved in really trying to figure out exactly what are some of the promising practices, whether it's CERG groups, these employer resource groups, where they're actually taking cross-generational CERGs, putting them together to foster multi-generational learning, or whether it's companies who have reverse mentoring and mentoring programs. So we're trying to elevate a lot of those practices with the hope that many companies will adopt those. But we have some ways to go in terms of changing that organizational culture. One of the things we talk about at AARP is the fact that when you look at the longevity market in terms of exactly the amount of money people over the age of 50 contribute to the economy. Right. In 2018, it was 56 cents of every dollar. So if, you know, the population is quite diverse. So you would want your workforce to mirror the consumers that you actually serve. So hopefully, again, we're seeing progress, but there has to be significant momentum.
I think if you ask individuals what their values or thoughts and beliefs are, you may see some commonality amongst those different generations. I think when you talk about generational values, you're automatically putting in a us versus them. So maybe it's how you position or how you ask a question or have the conversation. So I, as a Gen Z, may have a value that is actually, when you start to have a conversation with an older worker, very similar. But because you fall into a particular category, the assumption is made that your values are different, perhaps, than the other generation that you're describing or you have in the room. So looking at individual values and finding the commonality could be a different approach.
I think there has been some research recently that did say some of these big barriers between generations are somewhat overstated. But first, I want to say I commend you and everything you said about trying to think about how you change your hiring strategies and stuff. So that's just fabulous. There was also a study, and I'll maybe even try and look it up while we're sitting here, but what it found was that among younger workers who are very dedicated to social justice and environmental and sustainability goals and all sorts of, you know, all of the, in this case, I can say PC, you know, they were all about equity and diversity. And when it came to age, you know, they still think the older workers need to get out of the way because they're hogging jobs. There was this, they literally were able to document it. When they were told that many older workers need to work for financial reasons, you know, we have terrible savings rates for particularly low-income older workers. They have no savings, you know, so they have to work, right? Social Security isn't enough to get by. So when they hear that, they're more empathetic. Then they feel like, okay, I can tolerate their presence. But there is actually documented research that shows that among a lot of younger people, politically correct across most issues, still feel like it's okay. It's like age discrimination is the last acceptable form of discrimination. Right. It still kind of hangs out there as, you know, it's okay to make, say, disparaging things about older workers. So
this is not just important for older workers and older people. It's important for our entire society. So maybe try to answer that question, and we'll wrap it up. So the young lady over there will be.
I won't go into the labor force participation rate, but that's the ball game to some. If you want to go back to your sports things, but one of my fears right now, with all the talk about how many people have retired who wouldn't have retired had it not been for the pandemic, is that the older worker set of issues is even going to get less airtime. Yep. We're going to completely wipe it off, that they were just not interested anymore. I know we don't have time to really come up with a solution, but I agree. I think it's absolutely critical.
And what gets measured gets managed, right? And so when we're starting, as we're reporting our companies, HR professionals, on their DE&I stats, they should be talking about age as a really critical factor, just as they would for women or people of color or other groups, right? And I think that we need to start to hold people accountable in companies, CEOs, mm-hmm. for that. Yeah. I'm sorry,
yeah.
Media?
Yeah.
And I'll give Gene the last word on this because I know we have to wrap up.
Yeah, I know we have to wrap up, so very quickly. When we have these conversations about work, I think we have to really kind of unpack it. What we're talking about is really a pathway to economic security. We're talking about a dignity of life. We're talking about connectivity and health. I know we didn't talk about that today, but there's a huge correlation between working and a lot of the social benefits. What I'll say is this, is the fact that we're actually going to be releasing something called the catch-up, to your point, Art. And the catch-up is, think about it. When you call a friend or a family member, you're calling a catch-up. And we worked with Bill Bellamy, who is a caregiver, caring for his father. And in the course of caring for his father, he's like, I never knew how Medicare worked. I never knew how this broken our system was. And how can I talk about this to other generations and to other people? And part of what we're doing is talking about redefining what it means to age and health and longevity and wealth, particularly in the sports, entertainment, and music industry, for that same reason. So let's have a conversation. But when we talk about these conversations, I think that to the point that was said earlier, that getting older is a privilege. There is a sense of value that comes with experience. So how are we tapping into that? And it's really a win-win. And I think the opportunity that we all have is that it doesn't matter where you are within your organization or what level you are within your organization, we all have a responsibility and we all have a platform to utilize that platform to create a broader ecosystem that takes into account those who typically are not at the table.
Thank you very much, Gene, Maria, and Wendy. I really appreciate it. And thank you for all of you who participated and showed up for this conversation.
You've been listening to Work in Progress. I'm Ramona Schindelheim, Editor-in-Chief of Working Nation.